I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, bees are dying in record numbers, and their disappearance threatens much of the food that we eat. Bees help pollinate fruits, vegetables, nuts, and other crops, but industrial agriculture is making survival more difficult. Vast single-crop fields can leave bees without diverse sources of food, while pesticides may weaken or kill them. At the same time, development and the loss of wild habitat is taking away the flowers and nesting places where bees need to thrive. What is driving this crisis, and what would it take to reverse it? We'll talk with author and bee researcher Jeannie Durant about her new book, Bitter Honey, and their growing fight to protect pollinators. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source. But first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. Bees are responsible for far more than just the honey on our breakfast table. They pollinate many of the crops that help feed the country. But America's bees are in serious trouble. Beekeepers are reporting devastating crop colony losses, while wild pollinators are also struggling. Scientists point to a combination of threats, including pesticides, parasites, disease, climate change, and the destruction of flowering habitat. Another major part of the story is the way that modern agriculture operates. Vast fields of a single crop may provide bees with food for only a short period, leaving them with little to eat for the rest of the year. At the same time, commercial beekeepers must transport millions of colonies around the country to pollinate crops, exposing already stressed bees to chemicals, poor nutrition, and disease. Jeannie Durant examines the system in her new book, Bitter Honey: Big Ag's Threat to Bees and the Fight to Save Them. She is a writer and a researcher who has spent more than a decade working with beekeepers, scientists, and policymakers. Jeannie Durant, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we've been hearing a long time about colony collapse, and there was some sort of mystery that why were these bee colonies suddenly dying? Is it still a mystery, or did you crack the case?
Great question. Yeah, that's how I got into this subject in the first place. It was in 2007, and I was living in the Philippines on a Fulbright scholarship and researching bees and was reading all about colony collapse disorder. And it was a really unique set of symptoms colony collapse disorder was. So we had bee colonies. Beekeepers would open their colonies and they would find that their entire colony had disappeared, which is really rare. Typically when a bee colony dies, they'll die in the colony or just outside the colony. And so to have them disappear like that was really unusual. We haven't really figured out what was causing that exact set of symptoms. But since then, beekeepers have really been suffering from, I would say, four key stressors. And one of them, they describe it as the four Ps. And so that's pests. And Varroa mite has been the biggest pest that beekeepers have had to deal with. And pathogens, like diseases that Varroa mite spread. Pesticides are another huge issue for bees. And then another one that people know less about is poor nutrition. And so just the loss of diverse flowers and forage. So when I say forage, I'm talking about flowers that bees can get nectar and pollen from. And so we've really been losing forage across the United States, and that's been leading to poor nutrition. So those are the big stressors that our beekeepers are dealing with right now.
We can go over how important bees are to agriculture and the production of food. I think a lot of people already understand that. And the concern, we read the headlines and the lead in the story, if bees were to disappear, we'd lose like 2/3 of the food that we have and all these other, scary statistics. But is that really a threat? Could we lose all the bees or enough bees really to have a huge impact on our food supply?
It's a great, yeah, it's a big concern. The typical statistic is that bees help produce about 35% of our major crops of the food that we eat. So it's about one third. And the concern is not so much maybe that all the bees will disappear, but that we would have, first of all, that beekeeping is becoming far more expensive. Beekeepers often internalize the costs of all the losses that we hear about in the news. But the truth is that it's becoming increasingly more difficult and expensive. And so what can happen then is that beekeepers have fewer bees to pollinate a crop, or beekeeping becomes more expensive for a farmer, and that those costs will translate to consumers, and that crops will have fewer lower harvests. They won't have as produce as much food. Maybe the fruit or vegetables will be smaller. And also, it may not sound like a big issue, but scientists did a study recently that showed that about somewhere between 400 and 500,000 deaths are caused each year from insufficient pollination. And one reason is because bees are producing some of the most nutritious food that we eat. So vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E, are often produced by bee-pollinated foods, or eaten, we consume them through bee-pollinated foods. And so the concern is that food will become more expensive, and fewer people will be able to access the amount that they need, and that we could see real nutritional deficiencies that can result in fatalities.
Could tiny little drones replace bees?
I get asked this question a lot. Not yet, definitely not yet. And it also would be such a tragedy, right, that we would have to resort to robot pollinators when bees also, because those drones would just focus likely on crops, but bees are also pollinating a huge number of the plants that that are all around us, and that so many other insects and animals rely on for food as well. So it would be a great, I definitely don't want to see us leaning in that direction, because I think it's so important to protect our native bee and managed bee populations to also protect all the plants and other animals, in our ecosystem.
Yeah, do we really want to live in a world where we don't have bees to pollinate our food? It seems like a dystopian situation.
I would say it's a dystopian situation for sure.
So, what's making beekeeping so expensive for commercial beekeepers?
Yeah, so a number of things. One of the biggest is, as I mentioned earlier, one of the big issues beekeepers face is this loss of what they call pasture, which again is just bee-friendly forage, but like large landscapes full of it. And so as they lose that, they have to supplement their bees more. And some of that loss is coming from urbanization. A lot of it is coming from the expansion of monoculture crops like corn and soy. But some of it is also coming from weather extremes. So drought can just eliminate vast swaths of forage that, beekeepers are used to relying on for honey production. And so they'll have to feed more sugar water. They'll have to feed more protein supplements. So I'm remembering a few summers ago, there was a really horrific drought in the Midwest. I think it was in 2022, 2021, anyway, right around there. And beekeepers were having to feed three times as much protein supplement just to make up for the loss of forage that they used to have access to. And sometimes that's just not an option, or they can't afford it, or they have to then ship their bees somewhere else and try to find a new forage location. Those are really hard to find. So supplementation is becoming really expensive. A second piece of it is, most of your listeners are probably also seeing, gas prices are so high right now, and beekeepers are shipping their bees on these giant semi trucks that pull like 400, or that hold like 480 colonies per semi. And they're incredibly expensive to ship. And so I was talking to beekeepers in February who were, or so I should say March, who were faced with all of a sudden the Iran war had started, and now the gas prices were spiking, and they were just in the process of putting their bees back on semis after the almond bloom and shipping them to the Midwest or to the South. And the prices were astronomical. And also, with tariffs, like sugar costs go up, and sugar is one of the main ingredients in sugar syrup. And so they're seeing a lot of the same, issues that we're seeing in our pocketbooks, but at this massive scale, because they're having to feed billions of bees.
And at the same time, commercial bee producers are facing cheap foreign honey, which there's some questions of quality about that. I'm going to ask you that when we get back from the break. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Bitter honey, big ag's threat to bees, and the fight to save them when The Source continues.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Jeannie Durant, scientist, writer. Her new book is Bitter Honey, Big Ag's Threat to Bees and the Fight to Save Them. She follows beekeepers around the country, finding out how they do what they do, the stresses that they face, what this means for their hives, and whether or not those hives will thrive. Typically, they are not. Too many stressors. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. Okay, bitter honey. So you go to the store, you buy honey. Frequently, that is cheaper foreign honey, maybe from China, and it's not pure honey. Is that right?
Yeah, so it obviously depends on the situation. But yes, there is a lot of foreign honey on our shelves. I think the number is something like beekeepers provide something like 30% of our domestic honey, and then of the honey that we, you know, that we consume, and then the rest is shipped in from outside the United States. And there's a definite concern about honey fraud or honey laundering. And so, for example, some of it comes from China, some of it comes from India and other sources. I was in India recently, my husband's Indian, and I interviewed some beekeepers there. And I was told that the kind of standard adulteration rate, and it's, everyone admitted it was quite common, was something like one part honey to three parts other types of syrups.
Like
corn syrup, except it's often rice syrup because that's the more common crop grown in Asia. And so, but it's the equivalent of corn syrup. And they'll sometimes add pollen to help it get through screening tests. They've figured out lots of ways to kind of bypass the screening tests that we have. And we also don't have as stringent regulations here for honey as well. So this gets by. And sometimes if it comes into one port and it's rejected there, it will just get sent to another port where someone won't reject it. And so there's definitely a concern about honey. And I will say it's not just adulteration. Other countries have different pesticide regulations and antibiotic regulations. And so we may also be consuming honey that has higher amounts of pesticides and antibiotics than we're used to or than would be considered okay here.
So just to go back to, you were told that it's one part actual real honey and then three parts some other type of syrup, corn syrup, rice syrup. So only about a quarter of that jar is actual honey.
Again, yeah, and yes, and that would be for the larger sort of shipments of honey that are coming into the U.S. It's very common.
And then it's bought and it's packaged and it looks like it's from your normal honey provider. You can't really tell.
It's hard to tell.
Unless you get it from your local beekeeper.
I was just going to say that. That is going to be the more reliable source is honey from a farmer's market, from a local beekeeper. I believe Costco does good tracing. There are other stores. My next book is going to be looking at honey, so this is still kind of on the edge of my knowledge, but it's as to where exactly all the great locations are for the best honey. But definitely from your local beekeeper is going to be your most trusted source.
What about pasteurizing honey? That happens. Why?
Some of what happens is that people don't like crystallized honey. And so honey naturally crystallizes. And in fact, this was to go back to your earlier question, a big reason why adulteration happens, I was told in India, is because Indians don't they think that when the honey crystallizes, that it means it has sugar inside of it and it's not real honey. And so they started adding the syrups to prevent the crystallization from happening. So it was kind of, they were adding this, you know, sugar syrup to make it seem like they were consuming authentic honey. And so some of the pasteurization happens in part just to kind of stop that crystallization from happening. When it's heated up, it's less prone to crystallization.
But it's not for any kind of health benefit. It's just for shelf life.
I believe it's just for shelf life.
If I eat local honey, does it help me deal with local allergies?
The science on that is still not super robust. And I think it's a little more anecdotal at this point. But I do talk to a lot of people who swear by taking local or eating local honey to help with it. And I can kind of see it intuitively, like you're consuming a small dose of local pollen. Yeah. And it definitely, I will say honey, local honey has a lot of minerals in it. And I think that local honey is a more nutritious source of sugar than some of our other options.
Let's go to Javier on the phones, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK for your questions and comments. Javier, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. Hey, I wanted to ask Janie, what might be the best type of flowers that one can plant to help the honeybees? Also, there was these honeybee or bee removal signs around town, you see. I found out it was one of my homeboys from the old neighborhood, and I asked one of his partners, hey, does he sell that honey? I said, I wouldn't eat it. Javier, why not? I said, man, he brings the trash cans full of that stuff, and all he does, he just poisons the whole thing. He doesn't remove the honeybees. He just poisons them. You know, who could I report that to if he's still doing that? And also the colony collapse disorder. I had heard a program not too long ago where the author said, yeah, they finally got it under control around 09 sometime. And the interviewer said, well, how come they haven't, you know, put that out? And well, they can keep the price of honey higher, you know, if they don't find out. But, you know, I'm for, hey, let's help the environment. Let's help the honeybees out.
All right, Javier, a lot there. Bee removal operations. There is bee rescue. That is something that is happening to have here in South Texas. You can find them online, and they are like a nonprofit, and they will go out and they will do bee rescue. But that's not always. If you can contract a pesticide operation, like a bug killer, they're going to come out there. They're going to kill the hive, not rescue the hive. Is that your experience, Jenny Durant?
Yeah, I don't have a lot of experience with this personally, but what I always recommend people do is to try and contact your local beekeeping association. So most areas have some kind of local beekeeping association where they can call them, and beekeepers would love to get a free hive or a free colony. And so they would come out, and they usually have the tools that they need to help remove the colony safely and without hurting them. There's a vacuum that you can use to suck bees out of you know, a space. And then that way that beekeeper can then use that colony, keep it alive, use it to produce honey, and the bees don't get killed in the process. So I really encourage people to contact their local beekeeper association for bee removal, at least as a first step.
And the first question about which flowers to plant to support local bees.
Yeah, so that's a really great thing to maybe contact a local gardening either association or a local nursery. I always encourage people to plant native plants, partly because native plants and native bees have long established relationships, and we really want to provide food for native bees as well. And we think about them a lot less than honeybees, I believe, but they play a really important role in our environment. But the second piece of it is, I know in Texas, for example, there's sunflowers, and bee balm has a really wide range in the area. But I do think just contacting your local nursery to get some of that information, focusing on native plants, not just because they feed native bees, but also because they tend to be most resilient to extreme weather. So they've evolved in those areas and have been exposed to extreme droughts in the past. And so they can tend to be more resilient to the weather extremes in those regions, and then be a more robust kind of plant food source available for bees.
In the book, you write about how there's a controversy about whether or not to plant clover to help bees.
Yeah, so that is that controversy is especially prevalent in the northern Great Plains and in the Midwest, where we have a lot of cattle rangelands historically, and there are clover and alfalfa. And a lot of the controversy is around is on conservation reserve program lands and EQIP, sort of USDA funded lands that where they pay landowners to take land out of production and plant it with some kind of cover. And in this case, some of the seed mixes that beekeepers want would have clover and alfalfa in them because they're a favorite food of honeybees, but they are a European introduced species and they're non-native and they can be very invasive and they can take over sort of native plantings as well. And so there's been a lot of pushback from native bee advocates and sort of native plant scientists and researchers and I would say ecologists who are really resistant to having those non-native seeds in the seed mixes because it's introducing and kind of continuing to propagate a non-native species that can be very invasive. So it's definitely a source of tension. And if there is clover in seed mixes, they do need to be monitored. But in the right situation, it can provide a really great food source for honeybees.
But honeybees are also non-native. They're a non-native stock.
Yes, they are
European.
They were introduced in 1622, potentially earlier, but that's our earliest recorded shipment into the U.S. was in 1622, and they played a major role in settler life.
So, but we don't consider like wild honeybees as an invasive species, or how do we think about that?
I would say it depends on who you talk to. So I've done when
do,
I was
do
doing...
they outcompete native bees like our mason bees and things like that?
So they can. So some of the this is still a huge source of debate as to how problematic are honeybees for native bees. And so if you think about a Venn diagram, there are going to be some foods that native bees love, like native plants that are kind of on, you know, one part of the Venn, and then on the other side, foods that honeybees like. And then there's going to be some overlap in the foods that both species like. But because these honeybees come from Europe, they actually tend to prefer a lot of different flowers. And so one of my colleagues did this whole study where he was, his name is Clint Otto, and he was studying bee food preferences. And he found that there was actually far less overlap than we expected. And now that was in North Dakota and in the Northern Great Plains. And so it can be kind of a regional issue. But I think the biggest thing that we are seeing is that when there's very little forage, honeybees are more efficient pollinators and they can sort of outstrip the forage that is available for native bees. And so it is still out for debate. We don't know for sure, but we are seeing a difference in preference, but there is some concern about competition.
What about the bees that came from Africa, Africanized bees, and they came into the United States and then we were all scared about killer bees? Are they still out there?
Yeah, they definitely are. And as our, you know, summers and springs are warming and those bees are progressing up higher in latitude into, you know, where regions where they weren't usually in the past. And they can be difficult to manage. They are prolific at mating, and so they can, and their genetic pool just can take over a whole colony. And so it can become more aggressive and harder to manage. Some beekeepers are able to manage kind of hybrid colonies or colonies with some Africanized influence, but a full Africanized hive can be hard to manage. But that said, there are beekeepers in like Central and South America who work with Africanized bees and propagate them, but it's just not been something that we've really done significantly here in the U.S.
And so the Africanized bees, the killer bees, that mania is over. They've kind of integrated into the space. If you have a European domesticated hive, you may worry about it could become Africanized, but it won't destroy the hive. You just have to deal with more aggressive bees.
I would say Most beekeepers are pretty nervous about having Africanized bees sort of take over their hive and would maybe consider that a loss. So it is definitely still a concern, but I would say right now the bigger concern is mites for beekeepers.
The mites.
Yeah, that's their biggest
concern.
Don't
Africanized bees, aren't they more hardy?
I believe they are more resilient to mites, yes.
And so, I mean, maybe that could be a good thing if we could learn to work with that. But anyway, we got to take a break here. I'm going to get Randall and Terry on the air with their questions. You can call in with your beekeeping questions, Bitter Honey. We got to get into the heart of the book about Big Ag's threat to bees and the fight to save them. 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Bees are in decline. They're facing multiple stresses. We're seeing bees, the colonies being collapsing. Bees are dying at record numbers across America. Bees are an essential part of our food system. How do we figure this? How do we square the circle on being able to continue to use bees in order to keep big ag running, but without putting bees in jeopardy? You can call in with your questions and comments as we talk to Jenny Durant, author of Bitter Honey, Big Ag's Threat to Bees and the Fight to Save Them. Let's go to Randall on the phones. And Randall, you're on the air.
Hey, I wanted to go back to the consumer angle of this. Obviously, we want to avoid Walmart, Target, maybe even HEB in this case.
We can't say Randall, we can't say that.
Okay, strike that. So then, as informed consumers, what kinds of questions should we be asking? If we go to someone who is at a roadside stand selling honey, I want to believe that everything is on the up and up there, but you know, sometimes you never know. So what kind of questions should consumers ask at that local dealer about what they're selling and so forth? How do we become an informed consumer? And also, we've often heard this thing about how you can tell the difference in taste between, say, a homegrown garden tomato versus a grocery store tomato. Can you taste the difference between natural local honey and some of the stuff that's been imported?
All right, Randall, thank you for the question. So let's go to the taste test first. Jenny, you probably tasted a lot of honey.
Yes.
Can you tell the difference?
Yeah, for me, there's a flatness to honey that has a syrup added to it, which some people like. Like, they want it to taste kind of like a syrupy or corn syrup, you know, rather than honey is complex, and it takes on the flavors of the pollen and the nectar and the flowers that the bees are visiting. And what I love about that is you can taste distinct differences. Like, I've tasted avocado honey, and I've tasted buckwheat honey and sage honey. And sage honey is this very light, very light flavored honey, whereas a buckwheat honey is thick and molassesy. I've tasted almond honey, which has a bit of a bitter taste to it, which is part of the title. Bitter honey is the honey that bees produce in almonds. And so there's definitely a range of flavors that that are kind of like the terroir of that area where the bees were pollinating. And I think you can taste a complexity to it on the tongue that is just different from syrups that I had, honey that I had when I was in India, for example.
And if you go to buy it at a roadside stand, and there are roadside mm-hmm. stands here in South Texas, people selling mm-hmm. honey, and certainly you can find that in the Uvalde area. They're not going to be adulterating the honey. I would imagine these are proud producers who would rather cut off their own head before doing something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most people should know that beekeepers here in the U.S., they know that the public is trusting them with their honey, and they take so much pride in producing, you know, honest, pure honey. What's difficult is just that it's so much cheaper to produce, bring in, ship in adulterated honey. And so they're really in this difficult bind where they are trying to do the honest, right thing. And they're facing, you know, this sort of dishonest market that is just pummeling them. And so most beekeepers that you are going to meet, they know that your trust is everything, and that they are going to be, you know, proudly, as you said, giving you this authentic honey when you're in this sort of farmer's market or roadside stand situation. That said, I do want to caution people, because I think some people might think, oh, if it's organic honey, you know, if there's a label that says organic honey, we really don't have a way to really check that. And remember that bees can fly 3 miles, sometimes more, to gather their resources. And it's really hard to know exactly where they've gone, and to know for sure that it would be organic, that they weren't exposed to some pesticides in some way. So it's the organic thing I would question, but I do think that buying from a local beekeeper is most of the time going to be a much more authentic honey, or an authentic honey, versus something you're going to get at some, you know, large store.
And if you can afford it, you're getting the real deal. You're getting the good stuff.
Yeah, and you're supporting a local producer, a local farmer, right? And yeah. I think that's they need our support.
Let's go to Terry. Terry, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I hope I'm okay on volume.
Yes, go ahead.
My question had to do with the adulteration of honey. I know that there's testing that can be done to determine if there are what they call C4 compounds in honey that you only get from grasses like corn and sugarcane. But is there no actual regulation? It seems like it's fraud to call pure honey pure if it's been adulterated. I understand FDA's got big things on their docket, like, you know, people drinking raw milk and getting sick. But, you know, it's still fraud, in my opinion, to allow that.
Terry, yeah. Thank you so much. And if you think honey's bad, wait until you start reading about olive oil. But Jenny, Jenny, what can you say? I mean, is this fraud?
I would say yes, and I would say it's also a source of real tension in the beekeeping community. There are a number of beekeepers who are pushing really hard to get stricter regulation, and it is a real issue in terms of the different tools that we have available versus what we actually use. And the concern, or sort of the reaction that they've gotten before, is that, and again, this is like one beekeeper telling me this one situation, but was that, like, well, nobody's dying, so at this point, clearly we're fine.
That's a low bar.
You know, we're not, there's less of an incentive to, you know, to really up the game in terms of regulation. So there's definitely regulation that's happening. There is some scanning that's happening, but it is subpar for most beekeepers, and it is allowing, you know, this honey that is adulterated to come in from outside the U.S. And so it's a source of great frustration.
Okay, let's go to John. And John, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just like to make an observation. You know, earlier I heard about the idea of, you know, crossing the honeybee with the Africanized bee. And that was just one debate that I've always followed. And people are always like, well, you know, if you create a hybrid, it would take the more aggressive, you know, hardy characteristics of the African bee, and the honey bee would stand a chance. And I would caution against that also, because, you know, if the honey bee took on the more aggressive characteristics, it would be seen in the public space as more of a threat. And I think the humble honeybee has a lot of sympathy right now at the moment, you know, because, you know, it's docile. You leave it alone, it'll do its work. And a lot of people, they like that. But, you know, if people were to be faced with an aggressive bee every single time they saw a hive, I think the public space would, you know, they would want to wipe out the bee, and
sure,
that would actually be a negative.
Good
a
point,
negative
John. Good point.
Outcome.
Thank you so much. So John brings up a fantastic point. I wanted to get to this. People die all the time from bee stings, bee attacks. I mean, you're much more likely to die from a bee attack than from a shark bite or something like that.
Yes. I mean, I don't know the exact statistics of that, but I will say in general, honeybees are only defensive or tend to be defensive when they are defending their colony, their hive, their honey, their larva, their queen. And so typically the most danger you're in with a colony is if you're, or with a bee, is if you're getting close to its colony or like harvesting honey.
We hear about all the time people mowing their grass. And then they got too close, and the bees hate that, the vibrations and the noise.
Yeah, that is definitely a thing. Or they, step on a bee. But for the most part, they're getting, and they can also be defensive when there's a low water situation. So, or they can sting, like say if you have a pool or something, and then they might be coming to the pool and be stinging you there. But for the most part, honeybees, the European honeybees, are not super defensive in that way, and or what people might call aggressive. But it's just kind of a reminder, it is a defense technique to try and protect their colony or themselves. They're trying to protect their resources from someone else coming and taking them for the most part. So they aren't, I think the caller is right, but I do want to add another piece to it, which is that, I mean, that is what sort of makes raising bees so tricky, is that they pollinate in the open and the queen bee leaves the colony and all these drone bees from the area come and inseminate the queen. Yeah, and they mate in flight. And that's what we want. We want open pollination that has a diversity of drones. Each queen usually is inseminated by about 15 to 20 different drones. And then she uses that that semen for the rest of her life to lay eggs. And it's a pretty incredible process. And it really keeps our bee population as diverse as possible. But it does make it a lot harder to kind of create the ideal bee, because who knows what drone from what type of colony is coming and mating with the queen. So there is this kind of randomness to it that is part of what helps bees stay diverse and robust, but it also can make it difficult to kind of propagate the ideal docile bee.
Taking another break here. Stephen, I'm going to get you on the air when we come back with your question. 833-877-8255 if you want to call in, talking about the book Bitter Honey, Big Ag's Threat to Bees and the Fight to Save Them. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back.
The largest sports tournament in the world is about to arrive in Texas, the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Teams from across the globe are set to play at Dallas Stadium and Houston Stadium in June.
Whether you're a diehard fan or just a little soccer curious, we've got you covered.
When the World Comes to Texas is a new podcast from KERA News.
We'll talk to the people holding down the sport and the culture here in Texas.
It's out now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. The book is Bitter Honey, Big Ag's Threat to Bees and the Fight to Save Them. We're joined by the author, Jenny Durant. Let's go to the caller, Stephen. And Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We have 7 acres of undeveloped land in the Hill Country. Is this a good time to get started in keeping bees? And if so, how do I get started? Do I need to prepare the land first by, adding more flowers? What are the ABCs and how to take care of bees?
All right, Stephen, great question. Jenny.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. A lot of people are like, I want to help the bees. I'll become a beekeeper. I would say first and foremost, I loved your idea about making sure that you're planting a lot of flowers, because the main message I want to impart to everybody is that there just aren't enough flowers for our bees, and they're hungry. And so the best thing that we can all do is to plant flowers, bee-friendly flowers. And so the other thing to keep in mind is that we can also be beekeepers of native bees. And so about 70% of all the native bees in the United States are ground dwelling bees, and they just need places that are not kind of tilled or disturbed and that don't have mulch on them so that they can have their nests. And so, for example, in my backyard, we have a little spot that's just for native pollinators, and we don't touch it, and we don't put mulch on it, and there's just a bunch of flowers there. And we have so many bees coming into the garden because of it. So I would say maybe don't worry about getting bees. It's a lot of work. But if you did want to get started on that, so I would say plant the flowers first and perhaps propagate native bees. But if you're really, really keen to, you know, get started beekeeping, again, I would encourage you to contact a local beekeeping association and try and find a mentor and read a lot about it. It's really easy to kill a bee colony. They tend to die from mites very easily, and you need to manage them quite intensely. And so I really encourage people to learn about it significantly, find a mentor, connect with a local beekeeping community before they get started.
And Sandra, let's go to Sandra on the phones. Go ahead, Sandra.
I hope I'm going to be able to talk. I'm driving. I have a couple comments of what you might have addressed this already. Development and pesticide, I would think, are enemies to bees. And then I was, we had some bees under a water thing in town, and the city came and helped us get the bees and gave them to a beekeeper. So that's something you can do if bees are on your property and you don't want them there. And another thing is flowering trees. We have a lot of flowering trees in our place, and we have tons of bees that come to visit.
All right, Sandra, thank you for that. So Sandra mentioned development, pesticides. So there is a lot of development going on. Is that one of the reasons why bees are under threat?
Definitely. And, you know, kind of the title is, so development is a key piece of it. And then also the spread of monoculture crops. So, for example, biofuel policies in the United States have played a major role in sort of increasing the surface area of corn and soy crops across the United States, and at the exclusion of pasture or conservation lands that used to exist before they were plowed into corn and soy. And so what can be difficult is that those crops come with a suite of agrochemicals like neonicotinoids. And so most of our corn and soy seeds, especially corn, a little less so soy, are coated with neonicotinoid pesticides. And that dust can come off in the planting less than it used to be with new technologies. And it can drift onto your neighboring pollinator forage. It can seep into the soil. It can go into the streams and affect aquatic insects. And so the pesticides are a huge issue. Sometimes they're not immediately toxic. They don't immediately kill the colony, but they're kind of like a slow poison that can affect foraging. It can affect queen reproduction. It can affect their ability to navigate. So they can have these sublethal effects that are really problematic and are likely playing a role also in their ability to fight off mites and to fight off the diseases that mites are spreading. And so they are a real issue in creating just like chronic sickness in bees.
Are bees like a canary in the coal mine telling us that there is something wrong in the environment, microplastics or whatever we got going on? And bees are the ones who are saying, we need to fix some things.
I think so. I think that bees are telling us that we need more flowers on the landscape, that we need to prioritize insect diversity and biodiversity in everything we do. We've got farm systems that are now, or farm landscapes that are now just monocrops. And in the past, we used to have a better integration of, we had cover crops, we had diverse farms, which planted more than one crop. And we had a lot of wild spaces at the edges of farms that provided habitat and forage for bees. And we're really losing that. We've got more of a like plant every acre possible mentality. We in California, where I'm from, we have real issues with food safety, real concerns around food safety, that animals might live in those wild spaces and then, you know, contaminate like spinach or other crops that are eaten raw. And so it's become a real concern, but this kind of pressure that we have and this aesthetic that we have for like clean, perfect, tidy farming, it really goes against biodiversity. And we really need to rethink that. And I like to say kind of let a little more wildness in into our landscapes to be able to keep our bees alive.
What are the commercial beekeepers telling you that we need to know?
One of the biggest things right now is they are under so much stress and they are not getting the support that they need at the policy level. So one, I wrote an article recently about closure, a USDA closure of a bee lab. It's the Beltsville Bee Lab. It's part of the Beltsville Agricultural Research Center in Maryland. And right now the plan is to close it in October 1st because there are some expensive but unnecessary renovations. But in the context of a war that's costing $1 billion a day, they seem much less expensive. It's like $500 million to revitalize the whole center. And this lab played a major role in helping beekeepers with their big crisis in winter last year, where they lost 60% of their colonies. And these scientists have helped them again with these crises. They've helped them with varroa treatment. And then there's this new mite, AAA laps or tropy mites, which are in Asia currently and very well will probably come to the US. And they are just decimating bee colonies and they propagate more rapidly than varroa mites even. And this Beltsville Bee Lab was one of the prime centers that helped with that research. And this is part of a broader attack on federal research that is affecting pollinators. There's a lab, a USGS lab, that is slated for potential closure because of certain parts of the USGS that they want to close. And then same with the Forest Service is facing closures of 57 of 77 research sites. And the Forest Service oversees something like 193 million acres of public lands, many of which are homes for native bees or provide food for managed colonies. And so I would really encourage beekeepers are really upset about this attack on pollinator science, pollinator research that supports bees and these programs that are really a lifeline to the industry and helping them to fight these issues that they're facing with pesticides, with varroa mites. So that's one thing that they're really frustrated about.
So the USDA, we know that Brooke Rawlings, Secretary of Agriculture, doesn't have an agricultural background. Mm-hmm. These people who are making these decisions, they just have never been on the ground. They don't understand what they're doing, what they're cutting. We've already seen that with screwworm. The cuts mm-hmm. they made is allowing mm-hmm. screwworm to come into the United States. So I guess more people need to be informed and demand accountability here.
I encourage people to contact their representatives, and if they are fans of pollinators and want to support them, that is one of the number one things we can do right now, is to contact our representatives and let them know how important pollinator science and funding for pollinator, you know, forage and research is to us at this moment, because that's a huge support and it's under attack right now, and it's also against the congressional mandates. And so that already appropriated the funds for this lab. And so it's incredibly frustrating. And beekeepers, the last thing I'd say on that is they're small. There's maybe something like, 1,600 to 2,000 of these commercial beekeepers. And so they already struggle to get the funding and support and attention that they need. And so I think that they're already, that's already a struggle for them. So the more that we can speak out on their behalf, I think can help beekeepers and bees across the U.S., because these programs also support native bees.
I hear all the time that bees are robust, they can bounce back, but are we asking too much?
Yeah, I think that we have a food system that is built on extraction, and we are pushing bees to the brink, and they are struggling, and our beekeepers are really struggling, and our native bees are really struggling. And we really do need to rethink how we manage land so that we can, and then the kind of how we regulate pesticides and how we support research to be better supporting our bee populations.
Is this an international problem or just a U.S. problem?
It's definitely an international problem. It kind of varies the severity of it, but a lot of countries use the same pesticides that we produce or that we register here in the United States. And so some of them have more stringent pesticide regulations and sometimes have fewer issues with bee declines, I think, as a result. But everyone is struggling with mites. And in fact, up until very recently, Australia had no mites. And then they recently had an influx of mites, and they knew they were kind of holding it off as long as they could. And now they're also struggling with it. So I would say bees across the world are struggling with similar issues.
Jenny Durant, is a writer and scientist. Her book is Bitter Honey, Big Ag's Threat to Bees and the Fight to Save Them. Thank you so much for coming on, talking to
us today. Thanks for having me. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, Tim Gutierrez, producer, additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides,